Some of the lords on Lysis Terrace were making wry jests as they refilled their wine cups. Welcome to the White Book Podcast, the original A Game of Thrones LCG podcast. Originally founded in 2010 as Two Champs and a Chump, we decided to rebrand when the game relaunched with the second edition. A huge thank you goes out to Fantasy Flight Games and George R. R. Martin for this game and world we love, and of course to my co-hosts and you, the listeners. Please, if you enjoy the show, leave us a review on iTunes or your platform of choice, comment on our Facebook threads, or even better, support us on Patreon. We love turning that kind of support back into the community. This is Season 10 of the White Book Podcast. But across the garden, Tyrion Lannister's mismatched eyes watched the champions dance as if there was nothing else in the world. Hey guys, welcome back to episode 395 of The White Book. We've got a little bit of a kind of different show for you this week. We are doing two interview segments, one with our U.S. Joust champion and our U.S. Melee champion after that. So up first, Michael, then Kyle. Without further ado, let's get to the interviews. Okay, folks, welcome to the first kind of multi-part White Book this week. We are going to be chatting with the champions of the U.S. Grand Championship, formerly Nationals. So first up, we've got our Joust champion, who I'm proud to have on the show for the first time. So why don't you introduce yourself, give a little bit of kind of how you got into the game. How long have you been playing?
Yeah, so good morning, afternoon, evening to those wherever you're listening. So my name is Michael Arroyo. So I started playing Game of Thrones at the tail end of 2016. I went to my local gaming shop here in Connecticut just looking for a board game to play with my girlfriend, and wasn't really looking to get into any card games. I played Yu-Gi-Oh! And Magic for a number of years, but didn't really have an insight of really wanting to get into anything else. But for some reason, the employee at my local gaming store was like, "Oh, do you guys like Game of Thrones?" I'm like, "Oh yeah, sure." So he was like, "Look at this game." And it was, sure enough, AGOT 2.0, and he was trying to explain the game to myself and my girlfriend, and we loved the TV show, and I love card games, so it was just a perfect fit for me. I didn't know if my girlfriend would really like it, so unfortunately, he explained the whole game, but didn't have a copy of the game in stock.
Oh, no.
Nope. So we had to do some research on our own. We found a copy of the game, just one copy of the game, at Barnes and Noble's. It was like 50% off, red sticker sale. I was like, "Oh, okay, cool." So I picked the copy up and we started playing the game and fell in love with it quickly, but didn't realize you needed three core sets to actually fully get the game going. So we ended up going back to Barnes and Noble the next day and picking up two more copies, and thank God they were on sale with the red stickers.
They were two? Oh, that's great.
Yep. So we were able to pick up just three sets of core sets, and then just really learning the game on our own. I think we ended up kind of sticking with those intro suggested decks. I don't remember what they were. I don't know if it's Lanny and Stark, but did those intro decks and fell in love with the game. Started to slowly get into the tournament scene here locally with some friends. I think we had only like a 6-man kind of meta group, but quickly felt like I was very competitive. I felt my competitive side was coming back out from the good old Yu-Gi-Oh days. And
it so sure did you enough, travel and compete for Yu-Gi-Oh or just kind of?
Yeah, I did. I traveled a lot for Yu-Gi-Oh locally here. And then I would go to their YCS's Yu-Gi-Oh Championship Series. Back in like 2014 was like my last one. So I used to travel with a group of friends here. I think the furthest west I went was like Chicago was my last event, but it was a lot of fun. I loved it. So got very competitive into Game of Thrones, made my first kind of big debut tournament at Winds of Winter last year, which was the first event for the NEC Tour. And I brought a deck that was just something that I felt comfortable with because I was playing it for a number of months, even before the agenda was released. I kind of proxied it and kind of wanted to, it felt like it was an interesting agenda. So it was Greyjoy Brotherhood. And I'll never forget at my first tournament, really big tournament. And I just did so well with it. Didn't think I was going to do well. I thought I was going to get, mopped by everyone, every single round, but sure enough, I guess surprised a lot of people out there with a Brotherhood deck that really didn't do well at tournaments, or even I don't even think people even really brought it, but I felt so comfortable with it, and it was just something that I wanted to do well with and wanted to bring to the table because it was the only deck that I actually had knowledge with at that point. And sure enough, fishing nets really surprised everyone. So
That has not seen heavy play in a long time.
So everyone knew about Rattleshirt/Brotherhood Intimidate. Like, we all knew that, but I kind of wanted to incorporate Milk of the Poppies in, and if I had to, I felt like I had to incorporate fishing nets because the Milk of the Poppies is an attachment, so it will allow that character to block. So I was like, well, kind of have to have another way of having that character not blocking a fishnet was the answer. So it was just pretty funny. So that was like my first big tournament. And then from there on out, got the bug. I actually made the final table against Roy Rogers, and that match can be found on YouTube, and I just got destroyed against builders. So but I got the bug after that, and I kept on going to events on the NEC Tour, and I did well in 2018 on the NEC Tour. So I ended up on the NEC Tour, I guess a fan favorite of the Rookie of the Year award. Nothing that was formalized, but a lot of people kind of came up to me. I think even Roy said it to me multiple times, and it brought joy to my heart just to hear someone like him and everyone in the community to recognize me like that. So I built the confidence to go to Worlds in 2018 and did well at Worlds. Didn't think I was going to do well at all. And I ended up getting, I think, 14th out of, I think we had 160 or 70 people.
Very solid, Ben. Yeah.
Yeah. And then I capped off 2018 by, I didn't win a single event on the NEC Tour last year, but then I ended up winning Red Saturday, which is the lead up of the NEC Tour. So I ended up winning that, and that was, I didn't realize until I ran into Roy at PAX Unplugged that the Red Saturday tournament has been going on for years.
It had to have been started around like 2008 or 2009, right?
I would think so. And just having my name on that trophy with people from back in 08 is kind of a huge deal, and it's a big,
big deal for the East Coast folks here. So to be a part of that, and I know a couple names on the trophy, it's just an honor. So that was my 2018. And then 2019, I just try to keep on doing well as much as possible.
I think you're succeeding. I think we've got signs that point the way.
It's been a great, very well this great, year. Great run for myself. And I just, the game is so good and the community is so welcoming. It's so much different than coming from a community like Yu-Gi-Oh! Or Magic, where a lot of players aren't welcoming, but this community, it's just tremendous. It's a total 180.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, this has been my main game for a very long time now, but I've been in other communities in the past, various other ones, Magic and HeroClix and things back in the day. And yeah, I've never been in one quite like this.
Yeah, I just love just getting with the folks that I like to play with and just having a great time, even if you have a bad day at an event. The after parties and just the after activities are just tremendous. Having a couple of drinks, eating some good grub, and just hanging out.
Yeah, it's always a good way to pick yourself back and dust yourself off after some bad beats.
Yeah, and I travel a lot for work, so traveling for this is just, I love traveling so much, so this just gives me another reason to get out of the state of Connecticut.
Yeah. Well, thinking of travel, I am curious because, man, I was hearing so much like late Friday night before I'm going to continue calling it Nationals for ease of my memory. But that Friday night about people having just travel nightmare after travel nightmare after travel nightmare. How did travel to sunny Springfield, Missouri go for you?
For Team Carpool, as we call ourselves now, it wasn't horrible. It was just long, very, very long. So we started our trip in Washington, D.C. or Virginia, depending on which part, around like 12 o'clock. We went to go pick up some folks at NovaCon. Mm-hmm. Yeah, NovaCon. And we left around, let's call it noon, and then we didn't arrive to Springfield, Missouri until 6 a.m. Oh. Well, I didn't. Myself and Sandy did not get to the hotel until 6 a.m. on Saturday. We did stop at a couple spots, had some ice cream, had some good burgers, but I have to give credit where credit is due. And Eric, who was in our car, he drove kind of the night shift. So we didn't really get to experience the heavy rain or the bad traffic for those who were sleeping in the car. But there was a little bit of, stop and go traffic, heavy rain here and there from what I was told and waking up to. But other than that, it wasn't really, really bad. It was just a long 16-hour drive.
Yeah, wow. Huge Tim for making that overnight shift roll then. That is poor. So you guys were very bold to make that long of a car ride, and I'm very grateful that you guys did.
Yeah, we have to kind of thank Sandy as well for organizing it all and making this happen. I know he did it last year, and then he also did it for Gen Con, so the man's just awesome.
Yeah, he really loves his Thrones travel. I don't know if there's anybody really that competes for most or best travel the Thrones player aside from Sandy. So that's pretty darn cool.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, so you did arrive and you played, and so let's chat a little bit about what you played. I think folks can make some guesses by looking at Jousting Pavilion, but how about you lay it on us in a little bit more detail than just Greyjoy Sun?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll take it maybe a month or two before. I was playing Greyjoy Sun. I was really intrigued about Greyjoy Sun when I saw Sean Emberly play it at Storming of Starpike. It was just very, very interesting. I wasn't really interested in Drown God beforehand. I was more of, before the restricted list, I was just kind of a mid-range temple player and playing bigs through Greyjoy with Wars to Come. I never, ever wanted to do passive power gain with Drown God until seeing the Sun package and seeing how powerful it really can be. And I was able to watch Sean's, I think, top 8 and top 4 matchup, and it just blew me away. So I had to kind of, you know, make my own deck from scratch and have some of my local friends help me build a Greyjoy Sun, Banner Sun deck. I think there might have been one list or a couple lists online, but it was more like a hand destruction with Great Wick, and I'm like, I don't know if I want to do that kind of build, but was working on it for a couple months, and I brought it to Dance of Dragons, and I got paired up with, actually before I even say who I got paired up with, my version of the Banner Sun was running kind of a lot of attachments with Milk of the Poppies, with Beguiled, Sigur Pax, kind of those two are normal, but I wanted to incorporate Milk of the Poppies. And I ran into 4 Bera players out of 5 rounds. Ooh. And every single time I played them, I think it was round 1, they marshaled Maester, oh my gosh, what's the Maester's name? Cresson. Maester Cresson. To just eat all my conditions away. I'm like, well, my deck is kind of supposed to control you and supposed to stop you from making challenges, and you're just eating away at my attachments, and then I'm falling behind quickly. So I had to take a break from that. I was really sour about it. But then brought it back to Lord of the Crossings and got second place. I lost to Derek Shoemaker in a very, 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 very close game. He beat me 15 to 14 power.
Whoa,
it was a very, very close game. It was a very close game. And I did not let that bring me down. So I brought Greyjoy Banner Sun back to Nationals. It was the deck that I felt very comfortable with. And with Tom Malucci just winning, you know, a couple weeks before at Gen Con with a Princess Promise deck, I felt like there was going to be a lot of that. And I don't remember off the top of my head how many Princess Promise decks there were, but there weren't as many.
There were quite a few, I think. Let's see here. Tournament statistics agenda. Prince. Oh, you know, less actually than I expected. Just 8.
Yeah, so I thought there was going to be a lot more, but because I felt like that matchup is – it's a very good matchup. It's not – I wouldn't say it's easy, but it's – getting free Desert Raider triggers is just too good. So my mindset was if I can get free Desert Raider, Claim Soak, Disciple triggers, then the Princess Promise deck wouldn't be too much of an issue for me. So I brought this deck in thinking that there was going to be a lot of Princess Promise. And like you just said, there wasn't as much as we thought there were, but there were still, I think I felt like Greyjoy Banner Sun was still a good call just because of the interactions between Desert Raider, Disciples, et cetera. You know, Aaron Dampier just being really, really good. So I brought that deck and I did very, very well. I'm not sure if you want me to go through each round or, you know, how the actual day went, but
you know, you don't necessarily have to go through each round. But I was planning on asking you for some highlights or particularly sweet plays or tough games you had. But that may also actually connect to another thought that I had here, because you were talking about
how the Drowned God style of deck was very different from the kind of more tempo-y stuff you'd been playing before. So I'm kind of curious then, what are kind of some of the pitfalls, I guess, is probably the more interesting question, to trying to play a deck like this, particularly at a long event like this. How do you stay on top of things? Does it feel noticeably harder to keep it together versus other styles of decks? Or, you know, what kind of thoughts do you have there?
So, this might sound corny, but it's very, very true. And this goes to anyone playing card games. And I think everyone who's competitive knows this. Throughout the day, if you're playing a tough deck, or you're just having just a long day of tournaments, 6 rounds, 7 rounds, etc., you have to stay hydrated and you have to eat, because I've experienced this year the worst pain of my life. I was at Winds of Winter. I didn't drink anything. I didn't eat anything. I was on an empty stomach. And by my top four matchup, I had this massive headache where I could not concentrate at all. So just being able to focus and not have distractions like that, it was something that helped me out. Like I said, it's kind of corny, but I had a big bag of beef jerky to kind of help me just eat throughout the day and make sure that I was on top of just my mindset, because this deck takes a lot of remembering certain triggers, interactions, the timing of things, because just as simple as, you know, missing a disciple trigger off of a Desert Raider or a Fanatic can really cost you the game. And as I mentioned earlier, my close matchup with Derek Shoemaker at Lords of the Crossing, it shows that the deck is, you know, one power away can kind of lose you the whole game depending on your matchup. So for me, just staying on top of it was just, you know, staying hydrated, trying to stay as focused as possible, and just try to ignore any, like, if you feel like you misplayed or you didn't do something optimally, just kind of stay focused and stay positive, because it's going to be a long game. And, you know, I don't know how it compares to playing builders. I feel like even with builders, you might have to kind of stay focused and remembering all the triggers. And, you know, it's a lot of brain power to remember all that, where, you know, the tempo-y deck, yeah, there's some interactions, but more of the thinking comes in when it's math, not just the interaction portion of it.
Okay. So let's go ahead then and talk about the day. Like I said, you don't necessarily have to go round by round. I don't know that if you made notes to recall that for sure this late anyway. But were there any matchups or situations that really stood out to you?
Yeah, the round three, and I don't think I wouldn't say I was upset about my round three loss. It was just such a good game. And it's, if you've gotten so close to winning, as such as one power away, and then you just lose because of one round, it's just heartbreaking at times. So round three, I played against Dustin, former national champion, great Stark player, one of the best players in the U.S., potentially the world with Stark. So he was playing Stark Crossing, and I felt like the game was really – actually, now that I'm remembering this correctly, I thought the game was really tilted towards my way, because I opened up with all three disciples in my hand. So I had two on setup. I don't remember what I had for locations or anything like that, but I ended up having Tarl, the third disciple, in my hand going into the first plot. So I'm like, well, this game might be over really, really quickly. And sure enough, it was not the case. I remember after the first round of challenges, he ended up taking Tarl out of my hand with an intrigue challenge. The third disciple from my hand after the second challenge, the second round of challenges. So I was just left with like kind of the disciples on my field. And I'm only talking about kind of the important cards here. So later in the round, we're getting really, really close. And I think I was up I was maybe like 11 to 5. And I got to – he ended up holding me off from winning the third or fourth round of plots. We go into dominance phase, and he had just – actually, before even dominance phase, hit this injury challenge that he did before was a claim to my Risen, and I only had one Risen in my hand. And when you pull a Risen, it's like, well, I have to kind of take the gamble of resetting, one, because Risen's out of his hand, and two – he's going to win next round if I don't. So I was at 14 power after the dominance phase. He was at possibly like 5 or 6, maybe a little bit more. And he Valors me. I don't have a Risen in my hand.
Ooh.
And all my power was on one of the Drowned God characters. And I went from 14 to like, not 0, but maybe like 6. And I ended up losing that round. Because of it, I was so close to winning, and I felt so upset because I was like, I thought I was gonna win. I had like a really good advantage, but at the end of the day, Dustin's a good friend of mine. Hugged it out, talked about it later, and he just told me, Mike, just continue, stay focused. You'll do good. Yeah. You'll win out. You know, you'll win your fourth round, your fifth round, and sixth round. Just stay focused. You'll be good. So after the third round, I think if you remember, we took a little break, got some tacos from the taco truck, and came back round 4. I did well. I was against Kyle Vansel. I felt like Greyjoy Crossing for some reason. I thought it was going to be a very difficult matchup for myself, but I ended up playing a good amount of them, and I ended up doing fine with it. I was kind of surprised by that, but... maybe it was just seeing, you know, Vince's at the right time and being able to see the right cards at the right time. But I felt like I got lucky there. I don't know about the crossings matchup for myself when it comes to Greyjoy, because they're really fast, especially if it's the version. But
yeah. From what I remember in the Golden Company chat, the folks that brought Crossing, I think, were deliberately doing that to try to outpace Drowned God and Prince variants just on speed. So that was the goal anyway.
Yeah, I just got lucky on both of those matchups that I saw. But then everyone's favorite matchup, round 5, the Drowned God mirror match. I swear it's a 50-50 chance of you winning depending on how the coin flips. It is ridiculous. I played Roy at Lords of the Crossing in Swiss, and then at the in the cut, and we split. He beat me in the Swiss. I beat him in the playoff, the cut. And then round 5, I played against Matt Clemens, Greyjoy, Banner of the Suns, and despite us just playing Drowned God, everyone knows how important initiative is. So I ended up losing this match. Because I think, yeah, we literally, it was funny. Every single plot we flipped was the same plot. at the gates, I think it was at the gates, then we both wildfired, and then we both played Return to the Fields, and then we both played 5-9-1. I'm like, you could not have timed this perfectly. So we both did the same exact plots, but he ended up being behind in power on the last we take Westeros plot, and he ended up winning in marshalling with Tarl. We were literally 2 power difference, and you know, initiative is super important for the ground job mirror match.
Wow. Wow. I'm just still boggled over the plot choices in order like that, especially because the plots that you were choosing are rarely ones that are good for both players from an like effect perspective at the same time, like wildfire. So it was really basically probably had to be gunning that hard for initiative and coming down to the same choice on that.
Yeah, absolutely. It was, we were having a ball. That was just hilarious.
Well, that's good. I'm glad it was a fun game. Sometimes that type of thing can just be frustrating instead.
Yeah, so that was round five. And then round six, I had a play against Mike Weaver, who's I know him from the NECT Tour events. He's also on my team for Team Night's Watch for Thermstoberfest. And he was playing Night's Watch Sea of Blood. And I feel like Night's Watch Sea of Blood is one of those decks that's very, very sneaky. It's a Ranger's build. It can be fast. It can be aggressive. It's just good. And I remember playing him for the first time at Storming of Starpike and not knowing what any of these Ranger cards did. And I quickly learned, because the things that he was doing to me at that event, I was like, oh, didn't know you're going to steal two power from me because of a reaction. I was like, sure, I guess. So I had to kind of quickly adapt and remember some of the card effects before our matchup. But ended up squeaking away from that one. Very, very close game there. Again, it's just seeing the right cards. And, you know, the Drown God Banner Sun package is very, very helpful for Sea of Blood. And, you know, if everyone remembers, you know, Banner Sun, not only was it used for Desert Raider and the Disciple triggers, but it was to stop Sea of Blood for making those military challenges, for using his Viper's Eyes to take away the Put to the Sword or Put to the Torch. And by seeing his Viper's Eyes, it helped me kind of squeak that game away, because he wasn't able to put to the sword my, I think it was Aaron Dampier, who had all the power on him. So that game was close. And then after that, it was the end of day one, and there was a lot of Greyjoy, so I didn't get top four, but I was happy to get a lot of swag from all of the nice things that you guys were giving away. So I was super happy about that, because I love alternate arts and I love different swags and kind of showing off where I've been. And it's just another thing. This was my first West or Midwest event, and being able to bring back some swag from your event to the East Coast is just kind of like a little show off for the people that didn't go in Connecticut.
Well, good, good. I'm glad you liked that. Mm-hmm.
And then it was, they call it top 32 here, but it was the play-in round for the cut, and I had to play against Greyjoy Prince that was Promise, and this was what we were just talking about earlier, kind of just being able to get free disciples in and just defend challenges and, you know, being able to trigger disciples just freely. And it was really, really kind of happening. It was happening a lot in this situation, and it was not a good game. It was one-sided throughout the whole game, just because I saw kind of all three disciples and all the things that I needed. So I kind of feel bad, actually.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Well, it happened.
Yeah. And then I apologize too. I was like, you know, seeing these cards, it's just, you know, sometimes it's how it is in the card games. And it was very, very nice. And then top 16 against Tom McKenzie. This one was a nail biter as well. We were talking about this game a lot afterwards, and I knew Tom McKenzie and I knew Anil were both playing similar decks, because they're honest with me. They're like, yep, we just brought the same list that was posted on ThronesDB. So I knew the list because I saw it before going to this event. And the one thing that I knew that I had to control was King Plot. And I, being the Greyjoy player that I am, I love King Plot. And they were playing, oh my gosh, I can't even remember that event. The king event for Greyjoy.
King event. Oh, Kings of Salt and Rock?
No, it's the, that's the attachment.
Oh, whoops. Every captain is a king.
That one. Yes, thank you. Yeah. They're playing that, and I knew they were playing 1X, so I had to take it out of his hands immediately with his Viper's Eyes, because if not, he was going to just roll me on King Plot. And he didn't have King Balon in his hand or on the field, so I was able to take that from his hand, but being able to stop him from doing his tricks on King Plot turn really put him back, because he wasn't able to trigger really much anything. And it was a very, very, very close game. He was able to, you know, trigger Reigns a couple times here and there, but it was overall just a close game. And then we have top 8 against Eric Green, and this goes back to what I was saying. The mirror match is 50-50, and it was literally a nail-biter, just like the game with Matt Clemens as well. I think Eric Green ended up having like 4 power left from winning, so he was at 11, he was at 11, and I was at 15 at the end of the game. But the mirror match, you can never predict them. It's whoever sees Tarl or Disciples, and you know, sadly, I was able to rip away his Tarl from his hand from an injury challenge, and he didn't see another one.
It sounds good for you.
It's good for me, but it's just a hard, like, I'm such a nice person that I want my opponents to have fun too, and it's like seeing them just sad, it just brings me down. I don't like to make people sad. I'm a happy person.
Yeah. Okay, that's fair. That's fair. It does sound like you've been very I don't know, collegial, very very friendly with your opponents as far as the stories of the interactions go so far. So
yeah, so that one was a nail biter as well. And then against Anil, same thing with Tom. It was just kind of just controlling his board with his I think it was a Beguiled, and also with Sacred Packs. Those kind of hurt. That's what I forgot to mention against Tom McKenzie. I think I saw Sacred Packs and Beguiled, but with Anil, that was definitely the case. Stopping them from making entry challenges where they thrive on, and being able to blow up certain locations with newly made lords, it was just really brutal. So that deck is fun though. The Reigns of Casimir, I kind of want to go back to that.
it's a definite change of pace.
It is definitely, yeah. It's not passive power. I love boats. But that's for another topic. And then lastly, the finals. This game I was the most nervous for, because this deck list, I haven't really studied it, or I didn't really know anything about it. All I knew was, and this was from people that I learned at Lower the Crossings, a couple people were playing it at Lower the Crossing. And opening up turn one with, is it Unexpected Delay?
Yes, yeah.
That was the story everyone was saying. Like, you know, that's what Targ, Knights of the Hollow Hill, does. And I was like, well, I need to have bodies out so this doesn't become an issue for me. And if you guys watched the match on the Sixth Ring live stream, you'll see that I had a mulligan to get more bodies out, and I was able to see, I dropped 3 or 4 two drops as my setup, and that just kind of helped me delay from being back so much. Mm-hmm. But also seeing one of the most broken cards in Game of Thrones, Vince, seeing him not once but having him twice. Or I'm sorry, having two copies on my hands is just, it's unfair. Super unfair to stop your opponent from triggering abilities. It's just, it's not fun. It's a very strong card. It deserves to be on the restricted list. That's all I have to say.
Yeah, some might say even more than that.
Yeah. But that was if it wasn't, I'll be honest, if it wasn't for Vince, I don't know how that game would have went, having two of them.
Mm-hmm.
But I give Chris so much credit because, yes, he's so Chris is just a great player. This was the first time I've ever played him. Very nice guy, just a great player, a person that you hear his name and you hear about him on the internet, and it's like, well, you got to watch out for him because he has a really good shot of winning an event like this, mm-hmm. or any event that he walks into. So sitting across from him and being able to play him was great.
Yeah, I mean, and I don't blame you for not only does he have that reputation from a lot of other events, but also just literally Canadian Nationals with the same deck just the weekend before that he also made an appearance in the finals with, right? So he had a lot of high caliber experience with that recently.
Yeah, absolutely. And he definitely showed up and showed that he knows the deck very, very well, being King of Swiss for this event and then making the finals again. So
yeah. And kind of funny, I guess it's Greyjoy son, Drowned God, I guess maybe kind of has his number since it wound up taking down both U.S. and Canadian Nationals.
Yeah, it was. That weekend when Canadian Nats was going on, I wanted to win the Lord of the Crossing so bad because I wanted, you know, back to back Greyjoy Sun winners, you know, showing up on the Joust at the Pavilion, and I love Sean too, and it would have been awesome just to kind of share that with him. And then I guess I stepped it up by doing it one step better by going to Nationals and doing it. So having it show Nationals for the U.S. and the Nationals for Canadian being Greyjoy Banner of the Sun is actually a little bit better. But I just can't believe – I'm still in shock sometimes when I think about the event because everyone asks me – I was stood with – and I have to give these guys a shout-out because I don't think I would have made this trip happen if it wasn't for these guys. But Martin and Jordan, they allowed me to stay over their house for two nights. I had a business trip down in DC, and I wanted to kind of stay down there so it was easier for me to get to where I needed to be to meet Sandy and the crew. So they were saying, "Hey, how do you feel? You think you do good?" And I'm like, "No, I'm not going to do well. I don't have confidence. I've never played these guys out on the West Coast. I don't know how they are. I see a lot of these names, and there's going to be a lot of heavy hitters out there. And I always, every single event that I go to, I just try to be as humble as possible and just like, I don't like to be cocky. I don't like to, you know, think that I am the best player in the room because in Game of Thrones, I think that if you're a good piloter or you take a deck that you've been playing forever, you might outplay someone easily. And I think that there's a lot of surprises in this game that you might not be aware of. So I always go in there with, you know, let's just have fun. Let's have a good game, a good round, a good day, and a good after party, and let's just have fun with it.
You made sure to hit on the most important note there. Well done. The after party. Yes, that is.
Absolutely. I've learned at Red Saturday about the karaoke nights.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
it always has a place in my heart now because of that.
Definitely. They're always a great time. I'm not to delve too far into that direction, but I'm very sad that did not go as smoothly as we wanted it to after U.S. Grand. Oh, yeah. So that's a topic for a different time.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, thanks for coming on and chatting about your deck and your experience for a little bit. And now when Drowned God is just nuked into oblivion in the restricted list, we know that we have you and Sean to blame for that, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'll be signing Desert Raiders for all of the Martell players and say, you're welcome.
That'll be great. I'll have to get one of these. You can start like a mail-in service. I remember when I was a kid, you know, you could mail in baseball cards to a player. They'd sign it and send it back. Yeah, we're gonna start doing that with Thrones cards.
That's awesome. We should definitely. I love it.
Cool. Okay, well, here we go with one part of our kind of two-parter interview episode. So this week, I've got Kyle Vansel, co-host here, joining me to recap and look back a little bit on the weekend as our U.S. National Melee Grand Champion. So that's pretty cool, right?
Woohoo!
All right.
Yeah. I was like, I think it's my first win on like a big stage, like, I guess bigger than a regional. So it was, well, it is Melee. So I know many of you rub your thumbs. It was still, felt good to, have one of the old dogs get something and show that we can still play this game. And like Will and I talked afterwards. It was nice having like a table full of people that care about Melee and practice Melee, do well at Melee. I think it kind of validates the format some for sure, that when you try and care and think about it, that like the results show. That's not just a crapshoot.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I think there are too many people that give it a lot of crap. And I think part of that is because there is not a tracking system in place for Melee performance the same way there is for Joust, right? Like, there's no Jousting Pavilion website where people can go look up people's stats and say, ah, crap, you know, like, Will's got a, you know, 80% like Melee game win rate or something like that. Like, you can't look up those kind of stats the way people can and see that sustained sort of top of the results kind of performance. I mean, I randomly threw my name out just for giggles then, but I mean, I think it is the sort of thing that goes under the radar when you look at, like, for instance, we consistently have Melee events here in Springfield, right? At First Player, and when we have regionals, and now we've had the honor of having nationals a couple times and stuff. So even just looking since like second edition hit, right? Like, let's see, I won our first Melee First Player. Then I was at the final table the second year and lost to Jesse. Then I won earlier this year for the third year at Nationals. Last year, I was at the final table, and I was at the final table this year. I'm not necessarily saying that to toot my own horn as much as it sounds that way. It's just that because there's not that tracking system in place, it's easiest for me to remember my own record at this kind of thing.
Oh, sure. Like, I think I was at that first Melee final table, if I remember right.
You know, I think you might have been as well. That might be the sort of thing we could dig back and double check on, like, some old posts about the finals, like, scroll way back on that, you know, first player on there and recording. So we could track some of that locally here in Springfield that way, but it's much harder to track it at a broader scale. I mean, you wind up with other players like Jesse. I'm not going to touch any of that controversy, but you know, you also had him win first player. You had him Worlds. You had him, I believe, also at a final table at Gen Con. I mean, I can think of about one year in the last like umpteen that I didn't make the cut at the Gen Con Melee, that sort of thing. So like the consistent performance from people that play Melee and like work and practice on that game, because it is really a different game. Like that performance is there. It just does not get recognized the same way.
I think it's people struggle because it is hard to keep track of four individuals instead of two. And so much of it is soft skills that you do not have to have at all in Joust. Like, you don't have to feign weakness in Joust, rarely. You don't have to worry about if I get too aggressive with this person, it's gonna flip back on me and ruin things. Like, you don't. There's so many skills that just are not applicable to a Joust game that then people try to melee like a Joust, and then they get upset when it doesn't work. I mean, I probably knew only like 80%. I'm trying to like legitimize the format. And I'm about to say this. Like, I only probably knew like 80% of the cards in my deck, because it wasn't super important what those numbers were or the minutia, like, because like that's not going to be the deciding factor on this. Like, how I act and what I say in the moment is going to have a way bigger impact than if I'm running King's Roads versus Rose Roads, or if I, you know what I mean? Like, that's just
in the moment. I think you do still have to come into a game prepped with an appropriate deck for the format. For sure.
Oh, agreed. 100% agreed. Like, what is good and what is important is so different. And I guess since we both played similar decks, we can talk on that.
I mean, not just similar decks. I think at this point it's pretty open knowledge that the Golden Company exists, and our deck was, I'll say, effectively built by Bob, who is one of those people that derides Melee. And I've got a whole different theory there on people that can't handle it well, that like, there's a lot of competitive ego there that doesn't handle factors that like can cause them to lose sometimes. Like, sometimes you can lose on things that are not under your 100% control. But anyway, not necessarily meaning to knock Bob there. Just, he is a very competitive guy, so it made me think of that.
Sure, but there were like, so I was aware of the list going into the tournament, and then so like pro play by me, I said, you know what, I'm not gonna build a Melee list. I'm gonna put my back against a wall and make the cut at Joust, and this will help me do that. And then spoiler, I didn't make the cut. It didn't work. So that was bad. But it so Tommy handed me his list, and he was like, hey, this is essentially Bob's, but there's some differences going back to like minutia. And I was like, okay, cool. Like, I know the gist of that deck, and if there's some differences, I'll just figure them out as we go along.
Yeah, yeah. We massaged the deck a little bit, even after Bob posted the first one, to make a few Melee tweaks. And that, I mean, not many, probably maybe 10 cards or so that I suggested. And then Tommy tweaked a little bit further past that, but I would still expect it was probably still somewhere in that 10-ish card different range.
Yeah. So, but yeah, you definitely have to build a certain way. And I guess there's two... I guess I say a couple thoughts you can have going into this, but I think the big one is you have to pack some sort of element of surprise, if you will. You cannot play the game, from a what you see is what you get perspective. Whether that's Control or Rush, either way, like you have to be able to disrupt their math on how far you can get in a challenge phase.
Definitely.
Control, the same thing. Martell can kind of muck with some stuff, and okay, like there's a million events I could be running. What am I running? I saw a strong presence of Shadows. Same thing, right? Like I've got 5 cards in Shadows. Do you have any idea what they are? And it makes it so hard to do the math because it's like, oh, I'll do this and this and this. And then like, oh, never mind. I got Robert Strong, or, oh, I've got, you know, the Targ Assassin. Like there's just stuff that can come out of nowhere
and
that mucks with
it. And, you know, one interesting thing I really noticed about that Shadow stuff, now that you bring it up, is because the pacing of the Melee game is so different, and that just brute force like strength is less of an asset. Sometimes those Shadows cards are not what you expect they are. If you only pay attention to what's played in Joust, I got bit by that myself at the final table, and we can talk about that after a bit. But sometimes they are something unexpected because the surprise value is bigger than the sheer economic sort of value.
Definitely. And, you know, like trading is a thing, right? Like cards and Joust that are mutually beneficial, like no one runs because you don't want to do that. And there's enough efficient options that only help yourself. But sometimes it's better to pack something that you can make an ally or trade favors or things like that that are just overlooked cards. And then people play them and you're like, oh, that's a thing. I forgot that was a thing. And it can really rock your shit.
So what deck did you wind up playing then?
So I brought Barrow Rose to the table. Based on a lot of the concepts, like that we said, the surprise, being able to like feign weakness at times, the synergies can stack up very quickly, which is important. So they're like, oh, well, I just have like 2 knights out, and like you can kind of look like you're middling along, and then very quickly pivot to a position of strength. Other cards that are amazing that you don't think about, like Brienne, being able to sit and defend against 3 players worth of challenges is huge. And just a deterrent, right? Like the other thing that like Melee psychology is people hate losing challenges, and when there's only one person across the table, like you've one person to direct that aggression at, so that's where you're gonna go. But in a situation where you have 3 targets and one of them has this non-kneeling defending Brienne, like it takes a lot to goad someone into going at that person. It's like, well, I can get the easy challenge here. So they go there. Like it almost snowballs. Like by being strong, especially in a defensive position, that's the most effective defense because you're not going to have to use it. Mm-hmm. No one wants to sit there and like be the one who like grinds against that. So yeah, you may wear it down, but now you're committed all your resources and you're still more vulnerable than they are. And so those are kind of the concept of the decks. The other thing is like Carhold had just, you know, rocked out in Euros, HRD Carhold. So how do you get around that burst? If you're going to go rush, how do you get around the burst? Because you don't have Renown anymore. And that is just through good old fashioned power challenges. So,
well, and not only Carhold in Europe, but also it sounds like Rationing was a real force at North American Championships at Gen Con.
I didn't. Oh, yeah. Yep.
The Freefolk decks were running rationing, as I understand it, right?
Gotcha. I don't know. Yeah, I think I saw that. And so, yeah, so how do you get around that? You just max out power challenges. We ran all sorts of sand effects, all sorts of ways to do multiple power challenges. Again, messing with the math, right? Like, oh, well, he can do a power he'll get to 13. Oh, never mind. He can do another power challenge. Now he's up to 15. Like, that's the game you have to play.
Yeah. I mean, that deck, in the one game we were at the same table, I feel like that aspect of the deck went off harder for me than you. So I don't know if the rest of your day bore this out, but I think mine definitely did. That, like, on average, I was making, like, well, I say average and then I'm about to say minimum, but I would say I was probably making two power challenges per turn minimum, sometimes three or four, which is a lot, even if you can't, like, get Renown or trigger Starry Sept or something like that. That, like, that is just a lot of power that is moving around the board. And turns out it's moving to you.
Yeah.
Did you wind up, like, seeing about that many?
I honestly was a little more grindy than I was expecting on the day. And did not have the best of luck on that front. But, like, it happened when it needed to, right? So you kind of, at some point, have to bet on yourself and be like, all right, well, I'm going to keep stalling this out and playing patty cake and or playing possum, if you will, and keep this game. Like, it's very easy. The other, like, big thing I use a lot in melee negotiations is talking about keeping the table even. Now, that is not always good. There are certainly times where you want to create a situation where someone is like the black sheep at the table and you all just wail on them because you think you can outrush everyone else. But with a deck like this, like, talking about getting everyone back to even is always good for you because you are the bursty, hopefully reading the table, right? The burstiest, that's a word, deck at the table. So you just keep waiting for it. You're like, eventually I'm going to draw this tech. Eventually I'm going to get a Randall. I'm going to get an event. I'm going to get something that lets me push this over the top. And you just kind of keep things level and even keel until you get to that point.
I mean, and that burstiness was without going like the Superior Claim or Lady Sansa's Rose direction, right? The restricted Bob had originally picked was Clash of Kings, and that's what I stuck with. Did you also stick with that?
Yes.
Okay.
They're kind of the same reasons it gets around Carhold, and now I think it's easier to do two claim power challenges than four one claim power challenges.
Yeah. I can see that, definitely. Well then, so the day obviously went pretty well for you to make it to the final table. How was your record going into the final four, and were there any particular plays that really stood out to you?
I won one table legitly, and took a timed win at another and in a strong second place. And that game was one of those, like, I'm like, this is one of the reasons why people hate melee moments. I was pretty sure Mira was in a position to win. And so I negotiated and said, hey, I will, like, without any help, I thought Mira was going to win the game. And so I negotiated with her and said, hey, if I just lay down and let you win on against me easy, I can blitz up to like 12 or something and get like a really strong second place. And I'm like, I will make the path to victory super easy for you if you let me get these challenges through. Because she was playing Martell, so there's all sorts of interference, and that's the point of the deck, and I have nothing to deal with that other than my words. So that's the pitch I made, and she took it. And so I got a really strong second place, which ended up being part of what pushed me into the final table. So that's one of those moments where, like, everyone on the table's like, oh, come on, man, like, play to win. I'm like, I can't win. This game is over. So you have to do some of that jockeying. And that's another soft skill that I think is really important.
Yeah. Yeah, that is a tricky one where in Melee, when you put it in a tournament setting, there is a meta game beyond just that game. And it is, I think, beneficial to play to the best standing you can reach at that table. That is an issue that the game has seen in the past, shall we say, where somebody has rolled over to give someone else a victory. But I think there is a very stark difference between just rolling over to hand someone a table versus ending the game while you are in the best spot you see for yourself. You know, like you said in that game, ending it with yourself in a strong second so that it's over and done before anybody else comes along and, you know, bumps you down to third or something like that. I think that is perfectly legitimate.
Yep. So, and that was kind of my thought. I try really hard not to make those kind of deals. Like I said, I was 99% sure that Mira had the game. And if she didn't, she was bluffing well enough that I didn't feel like taking those chances. And so went for it. And she openly said, hey, because you made this easy, I'm going to honor that agreement and let you keep your 12th power. So
right on.
That ended up being pretty good. But yeah, then a timed win. And then my final table I won. Kind of like what we said, I kept things real, even keel, and then see an opening, burst through it, suddenly you have 6 power you didn't have, and they get caught doing the math wrong, thinking you're going to come up short. Because usually in those moments, other people are also in that position, or at least people are scared they're in that position, so they will do begrudgingly the bare minimum to stop you so that they are not put in a weaker position themselves. So it's like, what is the very least I can do? And that'll come up again later in this story, to stop him. And even if that's like, all right, this gets him to 14, and it's like, maybe he has something, maybe he doesn't, but they're like, yeah, odds are good he doesn't, so we'll stop here. That is very real. So got to have that surprise.
Okay. Well, you mentioned the stuff coming up again. Is that the very final table you're talking about? Are we ready to move on to that?
Yeah, it's a party, and I think everyone needs to be invited.
Well, let's see how to set the stage here. I guess so. It was us, both of us, plus our. My metamates, Spencer and Dakota, and our Golden Company companion, Spencer. And again, I say, hey, we're a meta that plays a lot of Melee. And it turns out we stacked the final table. Go figure.
With different decks.
Oh, yeah. Wildly different.
It's not like we were on something like very different scenarios.
Yeah, yeah, wildly different strategies. I just meant, you know, folks that play it a lot, like, can get the reps. Like, they work the muscles needed, so to speak, right? So Spencer's playing Stark. I legitimately now forget, was he HRD Carhold?
No, he, Fealty?
He was Fealty? Okay.
I think so.
And then Dakota was also on Baratheon, but he was HRD Starry Sept and was just kind of going, like, balls to the wall, so to speak, that direction. So, yeah, I mean, the first turn, I think we all pretty well identified Dakota as the big threat. I forget exactly what his board had, but he had a solid presence. He might have had a Courtney Penrose off the bat, if I remember right.
Yeah, that was the big to-do early in the game.
Yeah. So we were a little worried about him being able to go a bit crazy there with the Starry Sept. So we really reined him in turn one. And if I'm remembering correctly now, was I actually last on that first turn?
I do believe so.
Yeah, I think so. And by that point, once Dakota was pretty well reined in, I think maybe he only had one character left on the board. Then I remember looking at the board and kind of saying, like, oh, wait a minute. You know what? I can make a couple power challenges here and a military somewhere. And I think, if I remember right, even the intrigue, I was like, it feels a little weird to go this fast, this early, but, like, screw it. Like, I think I can get up in the 10-ish power range. I don't think I ended that high. I think it was actually, like, 8. But, like, get enough that, yeah, maybe I'll just go for it. What the heck? And then suddenly the dynamic of the table really shifted. Go figure.
Yeah, I was, you don't want to say anything, but I was like, this is a real ball. Like, all right, go, we'll go. But you,
it was a really dangerous
made
play.
An early statement.
Yeah, it was really dangerous too, because I did not have like a wide or deep board, really. I think everyone at this point now, looking back at it, can agree, like, the entire game, basically, you had the best board the whole time, right? Like, non-kneeling Brienne, and I think a Marge and a Courtier and, like, something else.
But when you go up 5 power, like, it's a very easy sell.
Oh, yeah, totally.
For me to be like, hey... Look at this guy.
The game definitely turned into kind of a lot of pleading back and forth between Kyle and I, especially whenever Spencer revealed duel, right?
Yep, turn 3 duel.
Yeah. A lot of stuff had already been done to kind of beat me back down, and I was basically just like, hey, you know, you bottle me up for the turn. Either way, like whether my Robert gets killed or my Robert gets knelt, either way, I'm bottled up for the turn. But if you kill him, I'm out for the game. And Kyle is like bottled up a little bit from the kneel. I forget, on Renly, was it?
No, on Bob. So that was the thing, is we both had Bobs out.
Oh,
different Bobs.
That's what it was.
You had power. You had the intimidate mm-hmm. Bob.
Core Bob.
And I had the Bob where you pick what kneels. And it was my game to have. And it's between the two Bobs. If they kill your Bob, I can steamroll you to victory super easily. So I offer, the farm.
Oh, yeah.
Two turns of not attacking. Like, Dakota gets to decide. 2 turns of not attacking him. I'm giving him cards. He controls
Robert's trigger.
Robert's trigger for the rest of the game. Like, just insane things. And he still turns it down.
I mean, I think he could see if you were willing to offer that much, that was probably like make or break right there for you. That, like, he needed to choose Bob. Your Bob. Your Bob, I mean.
Right, but here's the moment, like, and I didn't talk about this earlier, like, here's some emotional manipulation that goes down. So he chooses to kill my Bob. I then, anytime, so part of this is Dakota's in a shit spot. He's like 1 character left. He is crawling back. So I'm like, this will be good. Like, it'll give you a chance to stabilize. Da, da, da. I make all these arguments. I try. So then anytime that it would have been good for him to have had control of the Bob trigger, I mention it. Anytime he's about to, like, do something mean to me, like, I mention it. Like, and you build up this emotional guilt on him, like, you've done this egregious crime against me. And that helps.
It does.
Like, that helps. That's emotional leverage. So instead of just being, like, an asshole and being pissed off at people, you paint this woe is me picture. Sympathy is better than anger. Never get angry at a melee table. Everyone will turn on you. No one likes that.
Right. And I admit that can be hard to do. I I personally had a little bit of a tough time with that in my second table of the day. Little bit more anger out than I should have, but anyway, I don't want to rehash that for those people, other than to say I was disappointed in myself for letting out more frustration than I should have. But at the final table, this particular setup then led to a couple of my personal favorite plays of the day, where my Robert wound up knelt from that duel, and then I played one of my tweaks to Bob's deck and played the Iron Bank Will Have Its Due to return Bob and get 7 gold to then marshal King Stannis so that I could just keep trucking. And I think I had Fury out already at that point, if I remember right.
Yes.
Yeah, so it was almost a better trade for me at that point.
Which is good, because it was a surprise move. It was the first surprise move. I tried really hard to villainize you off of it.
Mm-hmm.
Because you are the only person I think that was climbing in power. Like, Spencer had a strong Stark board, but he had nothing. He's only like 4 or 5 power. He wasn't anything where anyone was really worried about him. So my only real option of painting a threat picture is Will. Plus, I know Will has no control. I mean, that's the downside to this deck.
Right.
And where you have to be a good table talker, because it is your only form of influence. That Will can't do anything about it. Like, it's like, oh, I'm gonna cancel your stuff or strip your icon. Like, Will has no revenge mechanic in his deck.
Yeah, nothing. It's just try to make challenges back at you. It would be about it.
Yes. So, but yeah, you recovered really well from the quote unquote devastating blow that was kneeling your Bob.
Yeah, yeah. So I felt good about that. And, you know, I admit I don't remember a lot of details about the rest of that turn, though it went solidly for me. But I definitely remember the next turn, which wound up being the last turn of the game, if I remember right now. Somebody had revealed a forced march and wound up kneeling out my Stannis. So then we get to marshaling, and what do? The Iron Bank Will Have Its Due to return Stannis to my hand to replay the Roberts. Which I think both of those were very, very strong swing surprise plays that really kept me in the running to just trade out those big 7-drop beefy dudes as soon as they got controlled. Okay, I will just change to the other one. Sure, sounds great. So I was very happy with how that performed.
And those are, again, solid plays people don't think about. Mm-hmm. Or, okay, that's a great one for challenge math. All right, he's only got, well, kneel this, he'll only do 2 challenges, and it's like, whoop, never mind. Back in it.
Yeah. Yeah, so does that mean we're ready to chat how the game actually ended, or did you have anything else before we get to that?
No, I think the last round is definitely worth talking about. I think, to paint the picture, we're going into this, I think I'm at like 8 or 9 power. I think Will's at 10-ish. You were above me.
Yeah.
Spencer is at 5 or 6, and Dakota's at like 1 or 2. He has crawled back a little bit, but he's still in not the best spot going into challenges.
Yeah. I want to say he had 2, if I remember right, because part of my plan, I had the Stormlands at this point, so I could make 2 power challenges. So if I remember correctly, I was going to send both of mine at Dakota. So,
yep. And Spencer's up first.
Yeah. Spencer's up first. And, you know, my board is not looking great. I've been beat down. I've got a big Robert, but part of the shenanigans in trading out Stannis and Robert and that sort of thing was so that I could still afford to play some Chud to live through incoming challenges. So that Robert didn't die. And so
military challenges. We have no income challenges.
Right.
I mean, I have challenges with income, but
Yeah, sorry. Whoops. So yeah, Spencer's going first, then it goes to Dakota, then me, then Kyle's going to mop up, right? So
knowing Dakota has win or die out. That is also very key to...
Yeah, the two claims very important. So I really needed the extra military, like, chuds to kind of keep in front of stuff. But I've, you know, I'm looking at the board and I'm like, okay, you know, I think I can weather these. I take these hits. Dakota probably wants to make the power at me to pull me down. It puts him way up. Like, but if I remember right, if he didn't make the power, then he if he did make the power, he couldn't make the military, maybe something along those lines. But I kind of counted like, hey, if I lose that power with two claim, I think I'm doing okay. Kyle, meanwhile, is desperately talking to Spencer about what he should do with his military challenge. So what?
I am also loaded on the board.
Oh,
like, God. I have dropped like Marge, Renly, or not Renly,
Randall.
Randall. I've got like two Apple Knights out. Like, I have planted my flag, but I'm also going last. So the pitch I make is you worry about the immediate threat and then you move on to the next one. If you can't stop Spencer, what's it matter if you can't stop me?
Right.
Is the story I sell a table.
Or stop me, you mean, rather than Spencer?
Well, yes. Yeah. You just have to go person by person. You're like, hey, we, the three of us, have to stop Spencer.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
And then after that, we stop Dakota. Right. And after that, we stop you. And then you three stop me.
Right.
That's the gentleman's agreement we make, if you will.
Which I think is how it does normally need to be done. Definitely. So you wind up convincing Spencer with his oh-so-tasty Great John that he needs to be militarying me. Because I don't want my Bob knelt, of course, because I need him for challenges. So I don't want to defend with him. So if I don't defend with him, then he can throw enough military at me that Great John's intimidate can kneel my Robert, or, you know, vice versa. If I do defend, then Robert's knelt anyway and crisis averted. So I seem to remember he hemmed and hawed about that for quite a while. I don't really recall why, but he does finally wind up challenging me. And I have saved a gold because I have a Nightmares in hand. Nightmares added to the deck to deal with non-HRD car holds floating around so that people can claim power. So I'm looking at the board and I'm like, okay, this will be fine. I just Nightmares Great John. I let this go unopposed. I Nightmares Great John. I lose a chud here. Then, I lose one to Dakota or however exactly that worked out. It's like, but Bob's standing. I recounted everything very carefully. And I'm like, as long as Bob is standing and alive, I need no other characters alive. Then I win the game.
Yep. Because you have to let – you have the redirect. You have to let this military through because you need to be able to block redirect Dakotas.
Yes, that's what it was. That's why I knew he was only going to get the power against me. You are correct. So I declare no defenders, and then I ask Spencer if he has an action.
And then you fuck up.
Because I don't want to accidentally skip over resolving that. Because that is when I need to play my Nightmares. And the fact that I asked Spencer if he had an action, like, I have never seen a player look so, like, deer in the headlights as that. It was...
We were all spooked.
Yeah, it was mystifying. And he just...
I was legitimately concerned. Like, you lost this challenge. What event could you possibly have that's a positive for you in this moment?
Yeah, it was crazy. And he looked at the board and stuff. And I finally was like, hey, you know, like, I it's not that I'm staring at anything on your side that you're forgetting to trigger. I was like, I was just asking before I take an action. And he looks and thinks and he goes, okay, Winter is coming. And I'm like, shit. Okay, well, that sucks. But you know what? I've got the redirect. The extra claim still leaves Bob alive. It's fine. So then I play the Nightmares. Then he brings a card out of Shadows. A card, a card that I had assumed was Mira Reed, right? Because she's effectively the only Stark Shadows card that's seen play actually in Shadows in Joust. And I don't actually need Robert's renown to win the game. I just need him to be able to make the challenges and have the King trait so he can be stood by Stormlands. So I'm like, okay, whatever. Mira comes out, blanks Bob. Big deal, right? No, that is not what came out of Shadows. Instead, out comes Shadow of the North. Spencer did have a winter plot revealed. So now his claim is 3, and Bob dies. And my board is wiped, and I'm out of the game.
And all the air in this card shop is gone. Yeah. I have never seen a room go from to dead silence so fast.
Yeah, I could not believe that had just happened. And I brought it on myself. It was very obvious. I think Spencer was really not planning on going for one or both of those, that challenge, until I made him really stop and worry that much. So yeah, there we go.
And the Nightmares poke, like, at that point seems small potatoes. Like, you don't think you're poking a bear in that moment.
Mm-hmm. It goes back to the different surprise card scene play in Melee. The surprise factor can be so much bigger than the sheer efficiency factor, because I had it dead set in my head that that was Mira, and I did not need to worry at all about Mira. But that's not what it was.
So Spencer then goes on to almost win on the backs of two superior claims. He plays one there, and then he goes to do, I think, the military. He does the intrigue unopposed at someone, and then he goes for the military. And I'm like, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say that was the military that he made.
Oh, that's a military use. So I guess
that's why you wipe my board.
He does the intrigue, and then he does a chump power at Dakota. And Dakota's like, I'm just going to let this one go. And I'm like, you can't do that. And I'm like, well, stop. Let's do the math. And I'm like, between rival bonus and unopposed, and if he had the superior claim, like, that's enough. Like, he will have bursted this whole thing up, and he will win on that superior claim. He's like, what are the odds he has the third one in his hand? Because he's already played two. Won this round. And I was like, if you don't chump block it, and you lose this table on that, you're never going to forgive yourself. And you harp and you harp and you harp until he eventually gives up. And he's like, all right, fine, screw it. And he chump blocks. And then Spencer looks super sad because it turns out he did have it. And he sold it very well. Like, he did a really good job being like, oh, yeah, I guess I'll just do this and play for second. And then no, that was not how it went down. Spencer could have won that table.
Yeah, exactly. I think it was very good that we convinced Dakota that, like, whether he has it or not, this is effectively probably the last turn of the game, and, like, you have to play like he does. You have to assume he does have it.
Yep. So then at that point, like, game is essentially over, we think. We're like, Kyle's going to win it. Dakota does some challenge – or does like one of his challenges, and you realize there's a way to stop me.
Oh, yeah. I had almost actually forgotten about this, because I wind up realizing that Dakota has actually managed to get a couple power on his Starry set.
No, he has no power on his Starry set.
No power. Oh.
But you have a way to get him that power.
Right. That's what it was. Because he has to win his power challenge that turn. And I want to protect my position at the table. So, and I still don't have a redirect that I've, or I still have not used the redirect at this point because I didn't need it for the military anymore. So I wind up convincing them that Dakota is going to have to power Spencer, which, if I remember right, didn't that knock Spencer below me in power totals?
You tied.
Tied. Oh, you're right. You're right. We did tie. So it, but it brought him back to tied with me, so that Dakota could get the power on his Starry Sept, and then use the Starry Sept to blank your Randall so that he couldn't stand to get two challenges. We were still giving you a power, but we would deny you one of the two that he would have gotten for his renown, and we deny you an extra body and a challenge. And I tell them, like, hey, like, basically you have to go along with this plan because Spencer can't, or dagnabbit, Dakota can't get his power challenge through on Kyle, so he won't do it there. And if he tries to do it against me, I'll just use the redirect, and he'll have to do it at Spencer anyway. in order to get this off. So they acquiesce and go along with it. So that
Which was amazing cooperation. Like, if you had told me at 13 power, hey, you need to give up two to stop this guy, I've done the math, like, I don't know if I if I trust you.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Oh, it was wild and crazy, but I was like, we have to do whatever we can. And I'll be completely honest that I'll be petty enough here that if you don't go along with this, I will make you go along with this. I will not sacrifice my power standing to help with this plan, which I felt a little bit bad about, but
didn't come up. They did not clap back at you at all. Like, hey, like, if you're so confident in this, like, I really thought at some point they were going to turn on you and be like, if you believe this will stop him, like, you're going to put up year two power to prove it.
Right. And they didn't make me use the redirect either. I got to sit on the redirect just in case I needed it for you, which I, if I remember right, I probably did bring up at one point.
Yeah, you were going to need to, because otherwise it's all unopposed your way.
Yeah. So I was like, hey, don't make me blow it, you know, so I can use it later, but I'll blow it on this if I have to. So thankfully they went along with that. Yeah, but we still weren't able to stop you. So how did that wind up?
So I wait for Spencer to go and declare the defenders, so everybody's nice and knelt. I'm like, this is the max value I can get out of it, just in case Spencer has some way of, like, stealing. If someone has some way of stealing Starry Sept that I can't think about, I was like, I don't even want the power on it. So before he can trigger it, I go and I nightmares his location, and their plan is foiled. Everyone gets real sad. I then get through all my challenges and win it with, like, one chud standing in dominance.
Yeah. Oof. So close. So close.
What a game.
It was a really crazy last turn. It could have been anybody's game, alas, except for Dakota's. But he still was a strong participant that last turn, at least. He was not just...
Yes, I mean, even you, with no characters for three quarters of the turn, helped strategize, make decisions, like, work stuff out, deflect and protect what assets you had. Like, for having no board presence, you did a ton of influencing in that round. And I think that's part of the beauty of Melee, is all the cool things and layers and changing situations that happened there. Probably some of the most fun I've had in Thrones all season.
Yeah. Oh, I agree. That was probably one of the best. That was definitely one of the best final tables and probably one of the best Melee games in general that I've been in. It was just a lot of back and forth and upset type of plays coming left and right from different people, you know, just a lot of chaos, shall we say. And Kyle made it to the top of that ladder first. But it was a great game. Spencer, I think, felt super, I don't know, awkward, but felt bad, felt guilty about his blowout military against me. But I really laughed that off. There was an earlier game, like I said, where I had a little bit of frustration issue. But this one, like, I couldn't even – there was no way I could be mad at that because it was such an amazing, like, glorious, insane situation and play that I had just egged on. And, like, it just – like, it was no – there was no fault or blame at Spencer's hand. He did what he needed to do, and like I congratulate him on that.
And as brutal as it was, like it ended up being the right play. Like if he doesn't do that, you probably win.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. Unless maybe because I didn't know you had the nightmares yourself, so I was not counting on that. So it probably would have depended on if you had thought to Nightmares the Stormlands in time. So I do think I needed two power challenges.
Oh, for sure. But even if I stop, you know, I don't have it for myself. Like, there's more that I have then no protection for me. Like, who knows? Maybe that goes another round. All sorts of crazy stuff happens.
Right, right. It would have gone an entirely different direction if it had not gone that particular way. So I like that. The paths are so many and varied in Melee. It rarely ever feels as predetermined as, say, Joust sometimes can. You know, sometimes I just sit there and I'm looking at my opening, like, marshaling hand first turn, and I'm like, okay, this game's probably already over. Like, sometimes that just happens. And I don't feel that happens nearly as often in Melee.
No, if it's well built, yeah, you should be fine. That, and, like, there's just so many more ways to recover, right? Like, the titles, like, oh, I need gold, I need cards, I need, like, this redirect to, like, just slow things down. Like, whatever it is, there are so many subtle mechanisms built into it. And then, like I said, a lot of people have learned that unless you are the rushiest deck at the table, you can talk yourself out of being that black sheep corner. Like, hey, guys, this isn't good. Like, you can wipe my board, but this guy's faster than you, and he's going to win.
Mm-hmm.
So it's in your interest to help me. And that's something that doesn't exist in Joust.
Yep. All right. Well, I think that's probably all I've got for Melee Day. This particular segment is already double the length of time that I had originally intended when I sold you on doing this one-on-one interview.
Like most Melee Final Tables.
Yeah exactly. But I definitely want to congratulate you again. Well done, man. Think that is nothing to sneeze at, and I'm glad to see the title go to another old school guy. So yeah. Any other parting thoughts on Melee?
No, thank you, Will. Like, I'm glad that you keep the pulse alive on Melee. I like that about Missouri, and it's always more fun there. Like, sometimes playing, like, Gen Con and Worlds, Melee gets shitty, I will say, real shitty. And there's something about, like, the Missouri events where there's enough competition and skilled players there that you feel like you accomplish something when you win Melee in Missouri, but you don't get that cutthroat. Like, there were no teams, right? There's no one playing Free Folk, throwing dragon's tails at each other and using bows on each other. Like, you don't have any of that, but you still, like, feel like there was healthy competition mm-hmm. everywhere, and that's the sweet spot for me.
Yeah I think it's pretty much always a good crew playing down here as well. I agree. We tend to, for whatever reason, get the folks that enjoy the format for what it is, and that don't spend much time trying to bend it into something it isn't. So that's always good.
All right, Boo. Thanks for the chat.
Yeah, thank you.